Before we start with the lecture of today, there were two questions last time. One was from you about the product of T1 and T2. So the thing is this. So we have this T, which is and then if you define T1 in the way we did, and the same for T2, the way we did. So you pointed out that T is not this product, but T is this product. As you can check. And then when we have the partition function that is t to the n, so it is this to the n, but because of the cyclicity of the trace, then this is t1, t2 to the n. And then the rest follows. So this was the first question. The second question was about the derivation of the correlation function using the transfer matrix method. So we have the sum over all the spin configurations. Then we have this, and then we have this. Right? And so you remember that when we use our trick, what we do is that, well, we write this exponential like the product of terms that contain Si, so S1, S2 times H, S2. S3, and so on and so forth. And then we have SL, SL prime. And we sum over all the configurations. So now these are just numbers. So we understand that the sum over all the configurations is like the appropriate matrix product. So by inspection, you can see that. So when I have the term H, SL, SL plus one, then I can put SL here and I write the appropriate matrix for this part of the matrix product and the same where I put L prime near the other one and then the rest follows. It's just that. So it is not really a tensor product, but in order to write the sum over all the configurations as the appropriate matrix product, we do it by putting these numbers together with the same indexes, L and L plus one. So this is about the two questions. Let me erase. And today you will find an updated set of notes on the wiki. So, have you already done the tutorial with the exact solution of the quantumizing model? What? What? The Jordan-Wigginton transformation.
This was the tutorial on Wednesday.
You did it Wednesday?
Yeah.
So you know. So now we have seen that the critical point is at G equal one. You have seen it in two ways. One is perturbation theory, and the other one is the exact solution. But there is a third way, and which is very elegant. The reason why I show you so many ways is that usually we are not so lucky that we can treat a model with exact solution. And locating the critical point is very important. So we have to learn as many possible ways, and sometimes we have to mix them. And then there are numerical methods as well. And the quantumizing model is a very good play field because we know how to solve it exactly and everything is easy. So the one of the most important methods is the method of duality. Which has many, many applications. So what we do here is to do a duality, what we call a duality transformation. This duality transformation starts with the transformation between lattices. Okay? So let me write again my Hamiltonian for the quantumizing model in 1D. And now let's look at our lattice, okay? So our lattice is a chain. Okay. And we are labeling the sides with I, right? This is I, this is I plus one, I plus two, okay. Now, the dual lattice is the lattice that is obtained by placing a site, a vertex, for every edge. Okay? So let me have these empty dots. So to this edge, we associate this site. To this edge, so this I minus one, right? To this edge, we associate this site. And you can see that if you have periodic boundary conditions, there are the same number of sites in both lattices. Okay. So I can label this edge. So as an edge, this is I minus one I. Right? And this one as an edge is I plus one. So I could choose a new label for these sites. Let me call it M. That is defined by this edge. So M of I is this edge. But now I think of it as a site on the new lattice. Okay, so this is the duality transformation between the lattices. Now we want to define a new Hamiltonian on this new lattice. And to define it, we define a duality transformation between operators. And then we will define the new Hamiltonian on here as the transform of the old one. Okay? So let me now put here a suffix sigma that reminds us that this Hamiltonian is written in terms of the sigma operators. So let's define new operators that now are located on these sites. And these new operators are obtained by transforming the old operators. Okay? So let me call mu1 at the site M. And M remembers that it is related to the site I on the old lattice, like just this term. Okay. So this is a very easy transformation. The second one reminds you of the Jordan-Wigner string. So let me call this new variable mu3. And this is equal to the product. So this arrives at I on all the sites that are smaller than I. of sigma x. Okay, so these are new operators. So now we can forget where they come from and think just of these operators as defined on this lattice. So question, we know that we have a spin one half here, 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 and here. Do you know what is the Hilbert space here, 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 and so on and so forth? What do you think is this, the Hilbert space that we have here? So usually, okay, you can tell me, okay, but here we start with the Hilbert space and then we define the operators. Here you have given us operators on here without telling us what is the Hilbert space. But if the operators that I give you form an algebra and I can look what is the reducible representation of this algebra, I can infer what is the right Hilbert space. So in particular, let's look at this algebra. And so you see that M mu 1 square is the identity. Well, just because I have to square this, and this is the identity. And the same for mu 3. Moreover, so this is easy. Moreover, you can see that at the same site, mu 1, mu 3, they anti-commute. Can you see that? So I have a Jordan Wigner string that ends here with x, x, x. And then this term, the mu 1 term is z, z. So the only point that they have in common is this one. And here, the first one acts like z, x, and the other one acts like z, so they anti-commute. But this is the algebra of a spin one-half. So this means the local Hilbert space on this dual lattice is a spin one-half. It's not the same spin than before, but it is a two-level system. OK, so now let's operate this transform on this Hamiltonian and define a new Hamiltonian. So H sigma will be mapped through this duality transformation into a new Hamiltonian that we call H mu. Yep.
So I'm still a little confused, because isn't the algebra independent of the representation that you use?
Yeah.
So how can you infer the representation that you're in from the algebra?
No, what I'm saying is that if we had a different algebra, completely different algebra, not the algebra of a spin one half, then we would have a representation that is not, for instance, two-dimensional. So it would not be operating on a two-dimensional Hilbert space. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I'm talking about the irreducible representation. So, yeah.
So, in one of the first lectures, we defined the Hilbert space associated to the edges of a graph as the, you know, the tensor product over all the Hilbert spaces associated to the vertices for the edge connected, right?
Yeah.
So, is there a relationship between the edge Hilbert space of the original lattice?
No.
No.
No. So the new, so good question, but so the answer is no. So now we have a new Hilbert space that is the tensor product of these spins one half. And they are related in a complicated way that is essentially non-local. Okay. So the new Hamiltonian is equal, okay. So let me first write the second term. This is just the sum over M of mu 1 M. Do you agree? This term of the Hamiltonian maps into this term. The second term, so it is sigma x. So how does sigma x map in the new variables? Well, if you look at two strings, so I have x, 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 one longer and one shorter. And you take the product of these two strings, then here we have the identity because x squared is the identity here, so on and so forth, but the last one stays free. So this means that sigma x maps in the product of these two strings. So this is will be equal to mu 3 at m, mu 3 at m plus 1. So this is m plus 1, this is m. Okay? And this is equal to this, to g times minus j g minus 1 sm mu 1 m minus j sum over m mu 3 mu 3 m m plus 1. But now forget about the names that we give to the variable, okay? This is a chain with spins 1 half. These are operators that have the Pauli algebra, right? So apart from the fact that I call this mu, this is the same model than H sigma, right? It's exactly the same thing here, where instead of the coupling G, we have the coupling G to the minus 1. So I can say that H mu is equal to G times H sigma with g minus 1 as a coupling. And the same j. So let me put g here. And j is the same. So this is the first Hamiltonian. This is its dual. And we can see that it is a self-dual. So after duality, h sigma goes in itself with just g going to g to the minus 1. And then there is an overall constant. So this is what is called self-duality. So this does not happen all the time. It's a very non-trivial fact that a model is self-dual. So you can always define a duality transformation, but that doesn't always happen that you find out that through that duality transformation, the model is self-dual. I think that the 2D is not self-dual. The 2D quantumizing model is not self-dual. But now we can use this. Okay. So if the Hamiltonians have these relationships, also the energy level must have this relationship. But the energy level, so the energy, some energy level at the parameter g must be equal to g e to g minus. This is self-duality. So you see that the low g physics is mapped into the high g physics. Now, Now, let's use this. We see that by just knowing the model self-dual, we can find the critical point without solving the model, without doing anything, without doing any calculation. Okay, so the critical point is when delta EG is equal to 0. But then if delta EG is equal to 0, then also G times delta EG minus 1 must be equal to 0. And since G is different from 0, then we have that the point G, both delta EG and delta EG to the minus 1 must be 0. So if the critical point is unique, then G must be G to the minus 1, which would locate G critical to be 1. So we don't know if the critical point is unique. But what we do is that, so usually we have a hint. We try, right? This is an ansatz. Then we have other things that help us. For instance, in this model, we can already see by the initial discussion that there are only two faces, because one is symmetry broken, the other one is non-symmetry broken. So there must be only one quantum critical point. So without doing any calculation, but just looking what are the symmetry properties and the duality properties of the model, we can locate the critical point. OK, so this is duality. Goes up. I don't hear.
I cannot do the same things in two dimensions.
Yeah, but it's not self-dual. So you can define duality, but the model is not self-dual. In fact, to find a quantum critical point for the quantumizing model in two dimensions, what we have to do is to map it onto the 3D classicalizing model, using the same techniques that we learned for the 2D. And then we do numerics on it. And then we map back, because we know that the critical temperature maps onto the critical value for the couplings for the quantum. And somehow it's easier to do numerics on the 3D classicalizing model than directly on the 2D quantumizing model. OK. So one question that we should ask is, why do we care so much about delta E going to 0 to locate the quantum critical point? So there are two heuristic reasons. One is that every time we see that this thing happens in the thermodynamic limit, so when it's not due to a level crossing, then we notice, so almost every time, because there are exceptions, we notice that at the critical point, we have a diverging correlation length. And if you have a diverging correlation length, you can do this scaling limit, because then you are in a regime where the important physics is at large distances, and all this is very nice. The other reason is that because in a classical statistical mechanics, we define a phase as a domain of analyticity of the free energy. And in the quantum case, if we just want to borrow the same definition, it becomes a domain of analyticity of the energy density. And then we understand that if the gap goes to zero, you know, this analyticity could be lost. So all this is very imprecise because there are exceptions. And then you have to start ruling out all the exceptions. Moreover, we have another problem that is mathematically very challenging, that in the quantum case, what is the thermodynamic limit that we said n goes to infinity? It's not very, very well defined. I'll show you why. So when we define a Hilbert space, well, it is essentially a vector space with a scalar product. So we must be able to define this thing. Now imagine that we have a Hilbert space that has our form, our local form in this way. And we would like to call the thermodynamic limit the limit for n going to infinity of this object. So now let's consider a state phi. So I can do the same calculation, just a little bit more complicated. But without a loss of generality, let me take a product state. Okay? State that is just a tensor product. For the following, there is no loss of generality in considering these kind of states. And then imagine that as a state psi, I take the tensor product of states that are very close to each of them to phi I. So psi I would be just such that the scalar product with phi I is almost 1. So to be precise, I can say that this thing is it is 1 minus epsilon, okay? Epsilon being a very, very small number. Oh, epsilon can also depend on I. So now let me say that epsilon is the smallest of these numbers, okay? So when I do this, you can see that this thing is smaller . And no matter how small is epsilon, for every epsilon, the thermodynamic limit this goes to 0. So this is a catastrophe. In fact, it's called the orthogonality catastrophe. It says any two states in the Hilbert space are orthogonal. So where is our? So we don't have a Hilbert space to start with. So the thermodynamic limit is mathematically very complicated. So there is a way to get around that is called Gelfand-Neimark-Stern construction. And we can talk about it privately because it's not a topic for this course. But the point that I want to make is that we have some difficulty in understanding when n is very large, what is the overlap between two states? And why this is a problem? Because we would like to understand the quantum phase as a domain in which, if I move inside this phase, the macroscopic qualitative features of my ground state are similar. So they're not exactly the same, but they don't change too abruptly. So I must be able to say that two states that are in the same phase are somehow similar. So you immediately see that it seems at this level that they are always orthogonal in the thermodynamic limit. So they are always very different if they are orthogonal. Okay, so in order to understand then what is a quantum phase, we must be able to say, so we would like to say that a quantum phase is a domain in which the distance between two states is well behaved. Then at some point, this distance becomes non-analytic, and that is a quantum phase transition. So we would like to understand what is the distance between psi and phi, where psi and phi are quantum states. So psi and phi are, in fact, probability distributions. So when you study quantum mechanics, you learn that psi square and phi square are probability distributions. But so these are amplitudes, but I can say, oh, they are quantum probability distributions. Okay, so they do not behave like a classical probability distribution. So in order to understand what is the distance between psi and phi, we first have to understand what is the distance between two classical probability distributions. So imagine that we have a coin. Let's start with a very simple thing. So a coin has two outcomes, one and two. And the probability the probability of heads is P1, and the probability of tails is Q1, which must be, of course, 1 minus P1. And the sigma, or the variance of this probability distribution, is where n is the number of trials in which we try to evaluate what are P1 and Q1. So what is P1? P1 is the number of heads over the number of trials. So, and as you well know, as we increase the number, then uncertainty becomes small. Our distribution becomes sharp. Okay, now imagine that we have a second coin, P2 and Q2. And I want to distinguish this probability distribution from the first one. Well, if P1 minus P2 is smaller than this, well, we will not be able to distinguish them. But immediately after, we can distinguish them. So I could define the distance between P1 and P2 as the number of distinguishable intermediate probability distributions. Okay? So now, not only we want to say if they are distinguishable or not, we want to say how far apart they are. So the natural scale is this one. We count how many probability distributions there are in between that we can still distinguish. So it's the number of distinguishable intermediate probability distribution. And let me put over this. This is a normalization because we want this number not to depend on n. Okay. So what is this number? Okay. Since we can distinguish them when they are within that interval, if I have many in between, I can count them in this way. I'm just counting how many there are into any such interval. Because they are very close, the variances are close, so I can just put one variable p and put the two. And this integral So yeah, you pointed out something important. So this distance defined in this way is not symmetric. So it's not symmetric. It's a statistical distance that is not symmetric. But we will see that the differential version of this becomes symmetric. Because in the end, we are interested in small changes around the probability distribution. But this one is not symmetric yet. So this for two coins. But now imagine that we have two probability distributions, P1, that has many outcomes. And I goes from 1 to n. And P2. So the distance now will be the same thing. Okay. So this is the statistical distance. So As far as we have classical distribution probabilities, that's it. This is how you define the distance. And how do you know, how do you evaluate it? Well, we have to evaluate P1 and P2. And experimentally, the only thing that you can do with a coin is to toss it and record the outcome. You record how many heads or how many tails or how many anything else if you have different outcomes. If you have dice, all you can do is to throw them. So what is special about quantum mechanics? How do I associate to psi a probability distribution? So I cannot just throw psi, right? I can choose what measurements I can take. So in classical probability distributions, we can just reconstruct the whole probability distribution by tossing the coin. But here now we have to make measurements. This is what we can do. But what is a measurement? We pick a Hermitian operator. Because it is Hermitian, we can diagonalize it and write its spectral resolution. Okay? So these are the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors of A. And then we can define the probability of getting the eigenvalue I when we measure A. If we are in the state psi. So let me call it psi 1. And what is this probability? So this is what quantum mechanics tells us. So this is how we construct a probability distribution. So now imagine that I have a second preparation of my state that is psi 2. And I want to distinguish it from psi 1. Well, now, if I measure A, I can obtain another probability distribution that is obtained by measuring A. And then I could say that the distance between psi 1 and psi 2 is the distance between these probability distributions. And I just borrow that formula over there. But wait a moment. If I, instead of using A, I do another measurement, I will find two different probability distributions. And I would find a different distance between these two states. So this distance depends explicitly on A. Right? It depends on what we measure. The essence of quantum mechanics is that if the different operators that we measure do not commute, then we find a different probability distribution. Only if they commute, we have a common basis of eigenvectors. And once you have a common basis of eigenvectors, this fixes the probability distribution. So it's in the essence of quantum mechanics that we cannot distinguish them perfectly by choosing just one measure. You don't know if it is the best one. So the best one is the most discriminating one. So we want to call the distance between psi 1 and psi 2 the minimum over all the possible measurements. So this means that we find the measurement that is most discriminating among them. Then we define the distance in this way. So mind that this is a completely operational point of view. We are really saying, OK, we prepare two quantum states in the lab. And we try to understand what is the measurement that discriminates the most between these two states. It's all about what operations we do. So usually, these tasks of minimizing over a whole space are impossible, right? Because you have an exponential number of things over which to minimize. But in this case, it's easy. Because there is a whole family of A's that one can prove, but the intuition tells us that this must be the case, that are the most discriminating one. And it is when I choose my A max. So I want to write it in a spectral resolution, right? So I have some eigenvalue. So the first eigenvalue is the projector onto psi 1. And then I have other orthogonal terms. Okay. So all these operators are maximally discriminating because I project onto one of the two states. So if you plug A max, the maximum discriminating, which is the result of this, inside this expression, what you find is cos minus 1, the overlap between psi 1 and psi 2. Right? Because all the other terms, all the other terms in that are here will be orthogonalized when I take the scalar product with psi 1. So this is the only one that survives. Now, if these two states are very close, so if this number is very small, oh, by the way, this is what we call fidelity between two states, f. So if f is very small, of course, this is this. Okay. Now this is symmetric. f does not depend on the order. So the differential form, when these two states are very small, is symmetric, and we call it DFS, where FS stands for Fubini Studi. That were two mathematicians, Italian and German. Fubini's, and it's called Fubini Study Metric. Okay. So this is the correct differential metric on the space of quantum states. Yeah. No, I just mean most discriminating.
Okay, so this is most discriminating.
Nothing to do with a number that is great. Is the A such that you reach the minimum of that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So one thing that we, the mathematically inclined, would ask is, oh, but we could have decided that the distance between psi 1 and psi 2 could be just this thing, right? We're in a Hilbert space, we know how to take a norm, we take the difference of two vectors, and we take the norm of this thing. So why we don't do that? So there are two reasons. One is mathematical, but we can fix it. And the other one is interpretational, we cannot fix it. So the interpretational one is that, what does it mean? Yeah, OK, it's a mathematical thing, but then what do I do to see if a distance is small? What is the physical interpretation of this? So it's great to be mathematically rigorous, but then you must know what it means. But this we know what it means. This is about looking at the outcomes of measurements. So we don't know what this means. But there is also a mathematical problem. Can you see what is the mathematical problem? So imagine that I put a face in front of psi 1. And I do the same for psi 2. So they represent the same physical state. Now, if I want to use this definition, now the distance between these two vectors that are supposed to represent the same one, the same physical states, becomes this. But now this can be different. We are making them interfere, even though this is not what physically is happening. Physically, we have two preparations that are, and we do separate measurements, right, to distinguish them. So why they should interfere? This is not one quantum state that is the superposition of the two. So this depends on alpha 1 and alpha 2. So already just mathematical, this is ill-defined. OK, so you say, OK, but just as before, there is no reason to panic. Just take the inf over alpha 1 and alpha 2. So now this is mathematically well sound. This is a good distance. Theorem that is complicated to prove. You prove that this thing is the Fubini study metric. So the operational defined one is the one that is mathematically correct, that we would have liked to define just using what the norm that we, the metric structure that we already have on the Hilbert space. So we have started from a completely different point of view. We have two preparations, how we distinguish them with experiments. And yeah, we find out that it's the same thing. Okay. So now this is a metric. So what we can do now is the following thing. Let's go to our quantum phases. So we have our Hilbert space and we have our Hamiltonian. And our Hamiltonian depends on some parameters lambda. And lambda can be many, right? Can be the Ising coupling, can be the external field, can be many things. Now I diagonalize the Hamiltonian for every lambda, and I find the ground state, psi zero lambda. So the collection of all these states with lambda is a manifold. So we know that this thing is almost always continuous. We know that occasionally there are discontinuities in some derivatives, okay? But almost always is continuous. And definitely it is smooth for finite n. So let's work at finite n, it is smooth. Then we define a metric. Just like in differential geometry, by taking the Fubini study metric between two states that are psi of lambda and psi of lambda plus d lambda. Okay, so this is our metric. And from this metric, we can define a metric tensor that will depend, of course, on the parameters lambda, curvature, everything. So tomorrow we'll give a concrete example because I need 20 minutes to work out the calculations. And we will show that. So we will take the quantumizing model. We'll take the explicit form of a psi zero lambda, okay, as a quantum state. And then we will see how from psi zero lambda we can derive these things. And we will see that when lambda is critical, so first of all, we will see that always this metric tensor scales with the number of particles, n. So the distance, the infinitesimal distance, increases with n. So this will scale like n, another metric tensor called g tilde min. So this is because of the orthogonality catastrophe. Just because we increase the number of particles, the distance increases, even if nothing special is happening in the phase. So we somehow define, we do define a normalized metric tensor on the, our space of states, g tilde, that takes already in account the fact that this scaling property. So now this one doesn't suffer from the orthogonality catastrophe. And we will notice that this one will diverge when lambda goes to lambda critical. So we will see a general theorem about this and the application to the quantumizing model. So now we understand what is a quantum phase. A quantum phase is a domain in which, if I change slightly my Hamiltonian, the new ground state is, yes, distinguishable, but it has a small distance from the previous one. So this is the precise statement of what it means qualitatively they are similar states. But across a phase transition, it blows up this distance. Okay. So a quantum phase is a domain in which how we distinguish quantum states when we change a little bit the parameters of the Hamiltonian is well behaved. And we will see the theorem and the application to the quantumizing. Actually, I will do the application for the XY model, which is another model that can be solved exactly with the same method than the quantumizing model, but it has slightly more interesting phase diagram that is two-dimensional. And we'll see that Monday. Questions? So the formal proof is not so easy. But so when I measure the projector onto psi 1, I am getting rid of all the other contributions. So I'm only keeping one term in that sum, and this will realize the minimum possible distance. So the formal proof is not so easy. I mean, the intuition is that I am measuring whether psi 2 is psi 1 or not, right? Because A basically is the projector of psi 1 plus other terms that do not count. So if I'm measuring whether psi 2 is psi 1 or not, this is the best measurement that I can do. But yeah, the formal proof is not so easy.
Other type of
distances,
like, for example, the relative entropy between
sure. Distributions. This is one. This is the Fubini. This is one distance. This one statistical. It's the one that is obtained that has the operational meaning that I described. What is the? If I want to measure by, if I want to understand distance by making measurements and distinguishing states in this way. So the others also have their merits, and they are useful in some protocols, but they do not have the same operational meaning. Plus, the Fubini study distance also is this, has this property. So honestly, I don't care so much about the fact that it is also the one that mathematically we obtain when we already use our norm, our metric structure on the Hilbert space. I think that the important thing is that it has the meaning of what we do in the lab when we want to distinguish two preparations.
The other thing, when you go in the second word in the last line, when you go from the cosine, the inverse cosine of the fidelity to times 1 minus the fidelity, that's in making an approximation?
Yeah, I said in the case when f is small, it's the differential. When f, for f small. So, and I said, this distance, as you pointed out, is not symmetric, but the differential one is. once you consider nearby states, because in the end I'm interested in defining a differential metric tensor. So then this becomes symmetric. And actually the full one, this one is related to one of these entropic, I don't remember which one now. There is also a way to relating to one of the many other measures of relative entropy or something like that. Yeah, Mandel, tell you which one.